Monster Man, special episode, The Witch of the Westmoreland, Westmere Lands. I'll explain everything. Hello, and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm taking a look at the monsters that I find in them, their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. Today's episode is a special episode, brought to you by the generosity and public spirit of my Patreon backers, and in particular, of Patreon backer Daniel. If you'd like to be like Daniel and get your own special episode, all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. And if you do that, in addition to getting to pick your own topic for a special episode, you'll also get access to the rewards for other tiers, including all new episodes of my other podcast, Patron Deities. So Daniel, thank you very much for your support, and I hope that you enjoy today's episode. Daniel has, I think this may be a first, Daniel has asked me to talk about monsters from a folk song, specifically. Okay, this song has been recorded under a number of similar but not exactly the same titles. I'm going to refer to it as The Witch of the Westmoreland, which I believe is the original title, but you will see it spelled differently, pronounced differently. I would normally, and I'm not from that part of the country, but I would normally pronounce it Westmoreland, with the two vowels in the back half of the word almost rhyming. Both of them just kind of schwa sounds. In the U.S., I would expect people to pronounce it with more of an O sound to the O, right? So the O, like more. And Stan Rogers pronounces it in a Canadian attempting to replicate Archie Fisher's Scottish accent, or something like that. The song was written by Archie Fisher. He's a Scottish folk singer. He was a Scottish folk singer. I believe he's passed away now. It was written in the 1970s, initially, I think, recorded by Barbara Dixon in 1971. Then Fisher himself recorded it on an album called The Man with a Rhyme. It was heard by Stan Rogers, who then sang it in a live show, which got released in 1979, and then I believe later recorded it on one of his albums. It's been recorded a lot of different times by a lot of different people, but I would say that for most people, the version that they're familiar with is the one by Stan Rogers. I don't know if I feel like I qualify as a folk music fan. I definitely went through a folk music phase, and like particularly a Stan Rogers phase. So I actually know this song pretty well. I was interested to learn more about its history because I knew that it was a cover, but I don't think I'd heard the original version, which is slightly longer, and I think maybe would have been a little bit too long. I think the form that it's recorded in makes less sense because some of the verses are cut, but I don't know that it makes that much sense to begin with. So anyway, my point in discussing the song's textual history is simply that this is a folk song in the sense that it is within the genre of folk music, but it is not a folk song in the sense of being a traditional song. It is a modern song written by a modern songwriter. He is specifically imitating a narrative ballad format that is common in like 18th century folk music, because most folk music, that's about when it comes from, right? The idea that folk art traditions stretch back into the Middle Ages or whatever, as opposed to being like intentional uses of medieval motifs by later creators, I think is not easy to sustain. So this is an original song from the 70s. And the monster that appears in it, if monster is the right word, is also something that Fisher created, although it is based on a story he claimed he'd heard, which we'll get to in a little bit. So I'm going to summarize the story of the song, and I'm just going to leave out, like, exuberant fiddle solo. So summarize, the story is pretty simple. There's a knight who's been wounded in battle, and he's sort of on the battlefield where he hears a raven, which is feasting on the dead of the battlefield, and it tells him that the only way that his wound can be healed is by this witch. And he's given some kind of basic directions by the raven. And in the original version, also by a hare. So the raven tells him to go catch the hare, and the hare tells him what the next step is. Something like that. Anyway, whether he gets his info from a raven or a hare, he rides together with his hawk and his hound. We are not told exactly where he is, but just judging from the order that he passes certain landmarks of the region, he must be coming from the north. So later on, he's given a set of directions that says, by the Ullswater, then the Breakfern Way, than the Kirkston Pass, which must mean that he's approaching Windermere from the sort of north-northeast. So he gives these directions to the witch, who lives in, as it will transpire, Windermere, which is a lake in this region. People will say Lake Windermere, which is weird because mere means lake, but never mind. So he rides until he meets an owl who gives him the more specific directions. He then goes down to the lake, and he tells his horse, hawk, and hound to wait for him. And then he walks down to the lake alone, and in it he throws some goldenrod, which he has gathered, I think on the owl's instructions, I don't remember, and throws it in. When he does this, out comes the witch, but in the form of like a centaur, one half the form of a maiden fair with a jet black mare's body. And she gallops away from him, and so he blows his horn, and his hawk, hound, and horse come to help him, and together they catch her. But when they catch up with her, she turns into her human form, and she realizes that he's, you know, this wounded knight seeking her help, and so she uses the goldenrod, which I thought was in the water, but whatever, to bind up his wound and heal him. And then she kisses him, they spend the night together, and she sends him off in the morning with a blessing, saying, there's nane can harm a knight was lain with the witch of the Westmerland. Like I said, this is not a traditional song, and therefore it is probably as symbolic as people expect folk music to be when it generally isn't. So if you look at, like, I'm sure you'll see this in, like, if you go see the song on YouTube or something like that, you'll find people explaining that this is a solar myth. And I agree that it's solar, but it's not a myth, because it's from the 1970s. But the idea that the night kind of represents the sun, or that the sun represents life, right? Like the sun goes down into the underworld at night and then comes back up during the day. I think that's very true. We get pallid color image early on in the song. Pale was the wounded knight. And then later at the end, we get the knight's recovery explicitly connected to the sun. He has risen hale and sooned with the sun high in the day. So I'm willing to believe that, and also that the witch who wears, quote, a gown of velvet blue bound round with a silver chain, close quotes, is a nighttime figure, right? She's jet black in her horse form. Sure, absolutely believe that. And we also get some birds that are associated with nighttime in the underworld. We've got the raven and the owl. And this is a nighttime journey that's associated with death. There's a certain eerie atmosphere. And the talking animals are treated that way. They're treated as eerie, not bizarre. So the knight does not react with surprise when these animals talk to him. But they're the only animals that talk to him, right? The horse, the hawk, and the hound, despite the fact that they're clearly his kind of faithful companions, they don't talk. Although he talks to them and they understand him. And I would say that these are all there to contribute to the mood. Even the witch's centaur-like form, I think, is intended to give us a sense of magic. We've said before that shape-shifting is one of the, like, great indicators of magic in folk tales and in mythology, maybe more so than it is to a modern audience. Whether this song is authentic or not, Fish has clearly been doing his homework. I think it's hard to explain the significance of the landscape here. I think this region is very associated in British culture and in British art with kind of wild romanticism, right? A landscape that's stark and stony, but still beautiful, that has a sense of liminality to it. It's liminal in a political sense as well. So it is part of England now, but it has not always been. Parts of the region were Scottish until sort of the High Middle Ages and the Early Middle Ages. It was part of a kingdom that just no longer exists anymore. Strathclyde, a British rather than Scottish kingdom, which if I recall correctly, and the history of this region is not something that I know a huge amount about, but I believe it was destroyed as a polity by the Vikings, or at least it didn't help when they attacked its capital, Dumbarton. So I think there's, again, that sense of kind of wildness and loneliness and liminality in this landscape. Fisher said, in the liner notes of The Man with the Rhyme, and then in later conversations, he said that he was inspired by a local legend about deer-antlered, deer-bodied women in Amir. That's interesting to me because the behavior of, you know, hunting, you know, blowing a horn and then the horse, the hawk, and the hound, that almost seems more appropriate to be chasing a deer, right? And chasing deer is much more like the behavior of a knight in a medieval romance. So I thought that was interesting. Anyway, he explained that these were just deer who had been crossing the mere, and they got like water plants tangled in their antlers, which gave them a long-haired appearance. I'm not aware that this is a widespread legend. It's not in Lore of the Land, that's for sure. And he relates it to a painting by a local painter named Joni Turner, but I couldn't find much about Joni Turner. I couldn't find examples of her work in a digital form. So if anybody knows anything more about this story, I'd love to hear about it. I like this image. I think if this was something that came out in a role-playing game in 2023, it'd be a deer for sure. Weird deer have been, I'm as guilty of this as anybody else. Well, I'm guilty. I do this as much as anybody else. There's been weird deer in role-playing games for like the last 10 years. They've been very fashionable. I don't know if it comes from somewhere or what, but deer skulls, a lot of deer skulls making the rounds. To give you an idea of the difference between this stark and romantic tale and actual local folklore, the two most notable Windermere monsters I could find out information about, one of them is in Lord of the Land and one of them isn't, are the Tizzywizzy, which looks like a hedgehog with insect wings and a squirrel tail, and is kind of the local jackalope equivalent, or is it a skvader in Scandinavia? Is that the thing I'm thinking of? And then the Crier of Claife, I'm probably mispronouncing that place name. The Crier of Claife is a ghostly monk who sits on a height overlooking the mere, weeping about his own sins. So what do we do if we want to convey the mood of this song in a game? I think there are a few main points. Because this is an example of a monster that is there to support the mood of a narrative. This is really a monster that inspires us to write a certain type of wilderness adventure rather than a monster that inspires us to use a particular monster, if you see what I mean. This is a monster that's about atmosphere. So what are the features of that atmosphere and how do the monsters support it? Well, first, atmosphere-wise, this is a landscape that is lonely. There isn't another human character in the landscape. The shape-shifting witch is the first person that the knight sees at any point during the whole story. You kind of get the sense of a sense of relief at speaking to her, and then of course they sleep together, so there's this element of kind of connection and intimacy. There's not even anybody else on the battlefield. We know there are dead people because the raven is feeding on them, but there don't appear to be any live people. My understanding is that, you know, a battlefield has a lot of people from one side or the other on it once the battle's over, typically. So I thought that was interesting. Stick a pin in that for later. Second, the creatures are unique, so we don't meet some talking ravens. We don't believe that this is the representative of a class of talking ravens generally. This is the raven. Maybe it's even raven, you know? Same with the owl, or the howlet, as the song calls it. If you search for howlet, the first result is Scott's Wikipedia, so there you go. So the creatures are all unique, right? There are three monsters, or I mean, say monsters, two talking animals and a witch, and they each have some kind of tie to the natural world. So two of them are animals, and one of them is able to shift into a part human, part animal shape. And we've discussed in previous episodes that these boundary-breaking monsters are very commonly associated with magic and witchcraft. So we're not dealing with, like, a Lovecraftian-type monster, which is, you know, from outside and can't be comprehended by your human senses. We're not dealing with a monster that is essentially just an animal, like a winter wolf or something like that. We're not talking about a monster that is relating to some form of human behavior, like a hobgoblin. These are creatures that blur the line between human and animal, or that mix or cross those boundaries. This is a type of monster design that respects, or at least adopts, the power of existing categories and boundaries in violating them. Next, these animals are not necessarily hostile. The raven is just pointing out a fact. Even though its cry is loud and cruel, as is described, it's just saying, in fact, it's being helpful. The first thing it says is, "Beck water cold and clear will never clean your wound." And the owl is just asking a sensible question. It flaps down, presumably, to see the knight, and it says, "Why do ye ride this way? Wherefore came ye here?" Their function as magical creatures is just to act as kind of signposts within a magical world. And ultimately, you know, speaking of non-hostile, the witch's magic is used for healing. And her response isn't angry when she sees the knight. It's skittish and frightened, bit like a horse, bit like a deer. When caught, she recognizes that the hero is wounded and shows compassion. Although, also, having thought about it, I do think that the we're not really encouraged to see the knight from outside very much in this story, but I do think that this is a moment that casts the knight as a rather attractive character, by which I mean that he is both capable in that he, you know, he has his hawk, horse, and hound set up and ready to go. He runs down the jet black mare, even though she's a quote fast and fleet, close quotes. In fact, weirdly, he sends two of his animals to get her as though she were two creatures. He says, course well me brindle hound, fetch me the jet black mare, stoop and strike me good gray hawk, and bring me the maiden fair. So that's interesting. So on the one hand, he's very capable, but on the other hand, you know, he's wounded and needs help, which presents him as vulnerable. So he's both got prowess and vulnerability, which is very kind of like romance novel sort of protagonist, right? Or not protagonist, love interest. Okay, so the thing that I can't quite shake is the idea that these monsters are here to denote that the landscape, particularly, so we have this kind of like quote-unquote unearthly landscape. It's misty, it's weird, and talking animals guide you through it until you meet a kind of test of your whatever, your prowess, which if you succeed, you will engage in a mystical union with a witch and then receive a magical blessing that will grant you not only like healing, but apparently some kind of eternal life or invulnerability or something. So I think the conclusion that we are not in the landscape of Westmoreland, but a mystic otherworld. I mean, that seems pretty obvious. And this brings me back to that thing that I stuck a pin in earlier, which is that there's nobody else at all on the battlefield. That's very hard to imagine. Did Ravens talk to the knight before this? I feel like they probably didn't. Could he be dead? Or at least in a liminal space between life and death? So he travels through this weird, misty, solitary landscape with only his hound and hawk and horse as company. Well, horse I understand, but what are his hound and hawk even doing with him on a battlefield? I understand that they are the fictive attributes of a knight. When you think of knights in folk songs, they are typically hunting rather than doing other things. You know, the rich are identified via their leisure pursuits. He has his animal companions with him in this mythic world, but there are no people around. And also, this kind of emphasizes the seriousness of the wound. So by that token, yes, maybe the knight is going to get healing for a regular old injury, but I think that this is quite a serious injury, a mortal wound even. The original song says, this is the hare's dialogue. So it says, green moss and heather bands will never staunch the flood. There's none but the witch of the Westmorelands can save thy dear life's blood. So what if, when you get knocked to 0 hit points, instead of, like, making some death saves or whatever, you have to go on a quest in a mystic otherworld? And to everyone else, it just looks like you're in a coma. But what's happening is that you are in some liminal space between our world and the afterlife, and you have to do some great deed in order to get brought back, or convince the gods that you're worthy of returning to life, or whatever. Interestingly, this is the system used in, I believe, the Warzone series of Call of Duty games, where if you die, the first time you die, you get to go fight it out with other players who have died to see who is returned to the game. And the idea is that this is like, you've been captured and you're like fighting to escape, but whatever, you know, you're battling the gods of death in the underworld to see who gets to be resurrected. A weird concept, but I kind of like it. Get knocked to 0, enter a mystic otherworld. This is present in Werewolf the Apocalypse, I think. If you're a werebear, you can go and like fight the death bear in order to be returned to life. So I think there's something there. This is very Glorantha. A lot of that kind of thing going on in Glorantha, right? People going down into the underworld to retrieve dead deities, dead people, dead concepts. Is that something? That might be something. Yeah. I think that's probably something. Okay. So that is about all the time I have to talk about Archie Fisher's 1970-whatever classic, The Witch of the Westmorelands, in today's episode. Daniel, thank you very much for your support, and I hope that you enjoyed the show. Everyone else, if you'd like to be like Daniel and get your own special episode, remember that all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. Or, if you prefer, you can pledge at a lower level. Or if you're not going to pledge at any level, or even if you are, one thing you could do that would be really great would be to leave us a review on the podcasting app of your choice, or tell your friends who might enjoy the show. For all my Patreon subscribers at the $2 and higher level, we've got an episode of Patron Deities coming up this week. Continuing our series on Haitian voodoo, we're going to take a look at Legba, the deity who opens the way for communication between humans and the Loa. At the end of this week, we're going to take a look at another lesser Cthulhu mythos monster, so I hope that you will join me then for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening. If you've got a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, why not get in touch? I'm on Twitter as @GonzoHistory, on Mastodon as GonzoHistory@Dice.camp, or you can find me on Instagram at MonsterManGonzo, or drop me an email, GonzoHistory@gmail.com. Our theme music is an extract from Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster and is used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Our cover art is by Ray Otis. Thanks for listening, and please join me next time for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great.